daring and majestic lies ever to bilk a hard-earned fortune out of a hard-working author. One ends up giving him another $15,000 or $20,000 or $50,000 just for the quality of his performance. There was an uncomfortable silence broken only by the change of plates by the waiters, and then Howells cleared his throat. Holmes had heard of William Dean Howells, had even read one of his novels, and found little unusual in the writer-editor-critic's appearance. Stolid form, short-cut hair, thinning on the front and top to the extent that Howells combed a few curly strands forward, a full mustache turning white, an intelligent gaze, and a soft voice. "Do you know, for me this is a most important, one might almost say, historical evening," said Howells. "Why is that?" asked Clemens. "Because of the overpriced mediocrity of this somewhat decrepit claret?" Howells ignored that comment. "Tonight, two of my most famous authors and two of my oldest and dearest friends are dining with me. I was beginning to think it would never come about."
"I've read," said Henry James, "that Mark Twain and I are as opposite in all things literary as the North and South Poles."
"I have never understood that bromide," said Clemens. "Certainly from what we know of the Arctic and what they are now calling the Antarctic, the poles must be far more alike than different. So saying that we are Howells's poles would mean that we're both cold, barren, impossibly distant, impossible to reach, and dangerous to travelers."
"However that may be," said James, determined not to be sidetracked by Sam Clemens's nonsense, "you, Howells, especially during your years of the Atlantic Monthly, have managed to make literary successes of both of us."
"Nonsense," said Howells, flicking away the tribute with his well-manicured fingers. "You both were destined for literary immortality. It was simply my honor to publish and write essays about your work. You often didn't sign the critical essays of praise that you printed in your own magazine, even while our books were being serialized there, Howells," laughed Clemens, obviously in James's estimate, feeling the wine. "I appreciated it, as I'm sure did Mr. James, but if there were an editor's board of ethics and review..."
"You know, Mr. Clemens," interrupted James before the joke could hatch into a full insult, "I actually met you, or at least shook hands with you, once before this."
"Upon what occasion?" asked Clemens.
They were now on the post-dinner wine and cigars course, and James could see that Mark Twain was enjoying both vices as he worked to focus his eyes a little better on James.
"December 15, 1874, said James. "There was a grand dinner in Parker House in Boston to celebrate the Atlantic's first year under its new owners. You were there, Mr. Howells?"
James turned toward his host and nodded.
"And so were many other well-known authors, now published in the Atlantic, as well as editors, various dons from Harvard and Princeton, architects, clergymen, although not the Reverend Henry Ward Beecher that evening."
"Ah," said Clemens, "that was in the early days of the Elizabeth Tilton scandal, was it not? Alas, poor Beecher. I knew him, Horatio. His sister Harriet was my neighbor at Nook Farm in Hartford. Poor Henry Ward had all those ladies in love with him, or at least with his preaching voice, and then most of the leading suffragettes turned against him like harpies during the scandals. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Victoria Woodhull, even his other sister, Isabella Beecher Hooker. They all wanted his hide."
"But his other sister, your neighbor in Hartford, Harriet, stuck by him, did she not?" said Howells.
"She did," said Clemens, "until the end. And since it's been 6 years this month since Reverend Beecher died of that sudden stroke, I raise a glass to him and to all poor men who are punished so by harridans and harpies for such venial sins."
All four men solemnly drank their toast to Beecher and his adultery. The other tables there in the restaurant of the hotel were empty. The waiters were standing, visibly waiting, their gloved hands folded over their crotches. James knew that the evening was over and that he had to speak now or lose the opportunity.
"Mr. Clemens," he said, "Howells mentioned that you were traveling up to Hartford tomorrow."
"Yes," said Clemens. "A necessity. Money, debt, and business. Just for the day, though. I'll be returning to Dr. Rice's tomorrow evening."
James knew that Clemens was currently the house guest of Dr. Clarence C. Rice, an ear and throat specialist who included amongst his famous clients Miss Lillian Russell, the aging actor, referred to earlier by Clemens, Edwin Booth, and Enrico Caruso.
"We wondered if Mr. Sherlock Holmes and I might travel to Hartford with you," said James, "and perhaps convince you to stop by your home there on Farmington Avenue."
Clemens stared as if he'd been asked to swallow a snake.
"Would you happen to know if your typewriter is still at your Hartford house?" Holmes asked quickly.
Clemens turned his head to look at the detective.
"My typewriter? We mentioned earlier that certain cards typed on that machine have been coming to Henry Adams, John and Clara Hay, and Clarence King for the years since Clover Adams's death. It might help me in my investigation if I were to see the actual machine."
"Your investigation?" repeated Clemens.
He leaned closer to Holmes.
"I have been polite so far this evening, but I do have to ask, are you really Sherlock Holmes? The 221B Baker Street Sherlock Holmes? The Come Watson, the Game's Afoot Sherlock Holmes?"
"I am," said Holmes.
"Well, then you, and James, and you too, Howells, if you're not doing anything important, are welcome to travel up to Hartford with me tomorrow, and perhaps we'll be able to get into the house if I cable ahead. It's being leased, you know. But first, Mr. Holmes, you must answer a most pressing question that has been haunting me all through this evening's fine meal and frivolity." "I shall if I am able," said Holmes.
Clemens leaned even closer to the detective.
"The question is simply this, sir. Are you real, or are you a fictional character? That is one of the things I am attempting to determine in this case of Clover Adams and the Five of Hearts," said Holmes.
Clemens looked at him and said no more. Howells gestured for the bill. They paid, and, since James and Holmes were staying overnight at this hotel, the Hotel Glenham on Fifth Avenue, the two men walked Clemens and Howells to the cabs waiting at the curb.
"Come, Howells," said Clemens. "We'll take this one, and I'll drop you on the way to Dr. Rice's place."
"But it is out of the way," protested Howells.
"In the cab, sir," said Clemens. "It would be unseemly for two gentlemen of our age and station to be arrested for wrestling on the curb at this hour of the night."
He turned his dangerous gaze on James and Holmes.
"It's a fool's errand you're on, gentlemen. But this great fool always welcomes other fools for company. I'll meet you all tomorrow at Grand Central Station at 9 a.m.
Chapter 23. William Dean Howells accompanied them to Hartford that Thursday. Holmes was not sure why, since he assumed Howells had a full business day in New York, and the dreary passing countryside was surpassed only by the dreariness of the conversation. In that one railway trip, Sherlock Holmes learned more about the business of writing and publishing than he could ever use. Clemens and the usually reticent James had been agreeing vocally, while Howells mostly listened and Holmes tried to catch a nap.
"Publishing is changing rapidly, and not for the best," Clemens was saying.
"I agree," said James.
"The magazines want a new type of story, if they want stories at all," said Clemens.
"I heartily agree," said James. "My number of short story sales has dropped off abysmally. A writer of short fiction can no longer make a living.
and subscription novels. Once my livelihood and the bread and butter of my own publishing house are disappearing.
Too true, Mr. Clemens.
So where in blazes are we to find our wages?
Demanded Clemens between puffs on his Havana cigar.
Even serialized novels are disappearing from the magazines.
Very difficult to place, very difficult,
murmured James.
Henry, said Howells,
his tired eyes coming alive,
do you remember about 9 years ago, I think it was early in 84, when The Rise of Silas Lapham was being serialized in the Century at the same time as your The Bostonians?
I was deeply honored that my modest early effort was sharing space with your masterpiece, said James.
William Dean Howells nodded his appreciation for the compliment. Holmes noticed a very subtle, quite hidden, but still, to him, noticeable expression come over Henry James's face. The look, gone before it could be seen for a certainty, reminded Holmes of a proper little girl who was going to say or do something mischievous.
Mr. Clemens, said James, did you by any chance ever happen to read The Bostonians?
A strange, embarrassed look came over the confident Clemens.
No, sir. Mr. James, I've not yet had that pleasure.
I ask, said James very softly, with more than a hint of a smile, because an English friend mentioned to me that I'd been at a banquet in Boston around that time, 1884, I believe, during which you said from the podium, and I think I am quoting you properly, I would rather be damned to John Bunyan's heaven than to read The Bostonians.
Holmes was astounded at Henry James's bold frontal attack on Clemens. Holmes had only known James for a short time, but everything he had observed in the writer's demeanor, everything, suggested that James would avoid controversy at almost any price, and if forced to react, would do so by the most subtle suggestion and most shaded, ironical nuance. Yet here he was, coming at Clemens like Admiral Nelson at the French or Spanish fleets, straight at him. Also astounded, it was obvious, was Samuel Clemens, Mark Twain. The other writer's face, so animated by dramatic scowls or controlled expressions of exaggerated surprise or joy in every other exchange Holmes had seen, now bore a look as blank and open and pathetically embarrassed as any 11-year-old boy caught with his hand in the cookie jar.
I
stammered Clemens, his cheeks and nose looking as though they might burst any second from exploding capillaries.
I certainly did not mean podiums, banquets.
The last two words were launched in a tone of disgust, emphasized by Clemens waving his hand as if wafting away a noxious odor. Clemens worked to light a new cigar, bending to focus all his energy on the business, even though he had two-thirds of one still burning in the ashtray. Holmes could see by William Dean Howells's paled and absolutely frozen face that he had been the one to carry original word of the insult to James almost a decade ago. James let a few more delicious seconds of this heavily weighted silence pass before he said,
But, sir, many readers, including this one, after sufficient time had passed, fully agreed with you on the faults of the Bostonians, and I fully and heartily agree with you, sir, that it would be the worst sort of hell to be damned to John Bunyan's heaven.
For a while, the silence ruled. Clemens held his cigar, James and Howells smoked their cigarettes, and Holmes puffed away at his pipe. The four men peered at each other through a strained but collegial blue haze.
Henry, said Howells after clearing his throat, you have diversified, as the businessmen say, into the theater, have you not?
James nodded modestly.
3 years ago, at Mr. Edward Compton's request, I adapted my novel The American into a play. The novel was not entirely suited to dramatization,
but writing and revising the play gave me much-needed theatrical experience.
"Did it reach the stage?"
asked Clemens.
"Yes," said James, "and with some success, both in the provinces and eventually in London. The next drama I write will be done exclusively for the theater and will not be an adaptation. In some ways, to be candid, I feel that I have finally found my true form. I find dramatical writing, with its emphasis on the scene, much more interesting than the novel or short fiction, do you not?"
Clemens grunted.
"I adapted my book, The Gilded Age, into a play, known by most folks as Colonel Sellers because of the strength of the main character, played by John T. Raymond. Do you know Raymond, Mr. James?"
"I've not met him or seen any of his plays," said James.
"He was a perfect Colonel Sellers," said Clemens. "This was during the Grant presidency, and President Grant attended one of the New York performances, and friends of mine told me that one could hear the president laughing all the way to the rear balcony rows."
"It was a comedy, then?" said James.
"In part," said Clemens. "Certainly John T. Raymond made it so. I would have appreciated it if he had played his famous turnip-eating scene more in the spirit of the pure pathos of poverty which I'd intended, rather than the broad comedy Raymond made of it. But I cannot complain. Colonel Sellers netted $10,000 in its first 3 months, and I imagine that it will make me $75,000 or $100,000 before it, or I, or both of us together, die of old age."
There was another silence then, amongst the four men, as the vulgarity of someone stating how much money he'd made from a job was left to drift away slowly with the cigar, cigarette, and pipe smoke. Holmes looked at Samuel Clemens with his most analytical gaze. Much of Holmes's job depended upon reading people as much as reading clues. Coming to a decision on the quality of a person, or the veracity of his statements, or the solidity of his personality, led to more revelations in detective work than did the inspection of footprints or types of cigarette ash left behind. Clemens, Holmes saw, used vulgarity as a device, not only to shock his audience, and everyone around him was, always, his audience, but to move beyond that shock at obvious vulgarity to some hoped-for higher level of humor or farce. Or at least to Clemens, it would seem, a higher level. As if reading Holmes's thoughts, Clemens removed the cigar from his mouth and leaned forward into the circle of men facing each other.
"What about you, Mr. James? What do you think of seeking one's fortune by writing for mere actors?"
James smiled. "I have friends who would say that such money is tainted."
"By Jove, it is tainted," cried Clemens in a loud voice while slapping his knee.
All of the boy's embarrassment and guilt was gone now, replaced by a boy's enthusiasm.
"The kind of wealth being made these days by writing for the stage by, say, that Irishman Oscar Wilde is twice tainted."
"Twice tainted?" echoed Henry James.
"Twice tainted," repeated Clemens. "Tain't yours, and certainly tain't mine."
Hartford was a dreary one-business town, insurance companies on every other dreary corner, and no civic architecture of any significance. But by the time the brougham carrying the four men to Nook Farm turned onto Farmington Avenue, Holmes and James could see the beauty of Mark Twain's old neighborhood. The houses were large but distinct from one another, obviously designed by architects with their particular clients' dreams and desires in mind. Each lot covered several acres and, while a house might put an iron fence around some of the front yard to separate it from the paved and gently curving avenue, the larger properties themselves tended to blend together in forest and glade with no proprietary fencing.
"See that gazebo?"
said Clemens, pointing into the trees between two fine homes.
"Harriet Beecher Stowe and I shared the expense of building that, since it sits right on the invisible line between our properties. She and I would meet there often on a warm summer day,
or brisk autumn morning to swap yarns and discuss the inevitable decline of Western civilization.
Is she still living?
Asked Holmes. Uncle Tom's Cabin had run on the stage in London literally for decades since his boyhood.
Oh, yes, said Clemens. Almost 82 now, I believe, and still as gracious and cussed as ever. The little woman, as President Lincoln said upon first meeting her, whose book started the Great War.
Their brougham paused to let two builders' wagons slowly pass, and since they were still gazing at the gazebo amidst the trees, Clemens went on,
Some nights when I couldn't sleep, I'd steal out to sit on the railing in the gazebo and smoke and admire the stars or moonlight. Often I'd find Mrs. Stowe already there. We'd talk till almost dawn, two happy insomniacs.
One must wonder, said Henry James, what two writers of such major accomplishment and diverse talents would discuss in the starlight or moonlight. The nature of evil? The past and future of the black race in America? Thoughts on literature or dramaturgy?
Mostly, said Clemens, taking the cigar from his mouth, we talked about our aches and pains, especially before Mr. Stowe died in 86. She'd tell me hers, I'd tell her mine.
Holmes saw Howells smile at this. Obviously, some Sam Clemens story was imminent while they waited for the dray wagons to rumble past.
I remember one night, said Clemens between blue puffs, when she listed her aches and pains, sure that they must signify imminent mortality. The darling lady was almost as hypochondriacal as I was, when I was amazed to hear that her problems exactly matched a recent list of my own, and a list of pains and symptoms of which I had just been cured.
Holmes folded his arms. The dray wagons were passed, and now their brougham turned onto a paved lane that curved up a gentle hill.
I told her, continued Clemens. I told her, Harriet, I said, my doctor just cured me of precisely those ailments. Precisely. What medicine did he prescribe? Asked little Mrs. Stowe. Why, no medicines at all, says I. My doctor just told me to take a 2-month sabbatical from my habits of heavy drinking, constant smoking, and exploding into wild bouts of profanity in irregular but frequent intervals. I told her, Harriet, you give up cussing, drinking, and smoking for a couple of months, and you'll be right as rain.
Clemens peered at them through the smoke, making sure that they were still absorbed in his tale.
Mr. Clemens, cried she, I have never partaken of any of those terrible behaviors. Never, says I, and I can tell you, gentlemen, I was shocked. Never, says Harriet Beecher Stowe, gathering her shawl around her because the night was nippy. Well then, my dear lady, I broke it to her with infinite sadness, there is no hope for you. You are a balloon going down, and you have no ballast to cast overboard. You have neglected your vices.
The brougham stopped at the crest of a rise, and there was Samuel Clemens's former home. Although he still owned it, he explained, for the last 2 years he and Livy had leased it to a certain John Day and his wife, Alice, the daughter of Isabella Hooker, for a much-needed $200 a month. Clemens said that he'd cabled ahead, and John and Alice would be out this afternoon. The house was theirs for the time being. Stepping out of the carriage, Holmes looked at the house. The sunlight created a rich mixture of shade and colors on 3 stories of salmon-colored bricks. The steeply pitched gables, along with 5 balconies, gave the large home a bit of a castle look. Its main window was on a 2-story tower and overlooked the porte cochere over the driveway. Clemens saw where the detective was gazing.
Some have written or said that I wanted that bit to resemble a riverboat's pilot house, he said, stubbing his last cigar out on the curb. But I didn't. That wasn't the plan at all. It's just, as they say, a happy coincidence.
Clemens fetched a key from a flower pot on the front porch, unlocked the door, and swept it open for them to enter. A few yards down the hallway, they could peer into the main rooms, and Holmes knew that it was a home dedicated to good taste and quality items. Sherlock Holmes's bachelor bedroom and sitting room at 221B Baker Street might be a toss-about mess, was a toss-about mess when Mrs. Hudson wasn't interfering, with everything thrown and dropped rather than folded and placed, but Holmes knew attractive domestic order when he saw it. He was seeing it now.
19 rooms, 7 bathrooms,
Clemens was saying as if he were a real estate man intent upon selling the house to them.
All the bathrooms with flush toilets, which was a curiosity in its day. Speaking tubes so that anyone can talk to anyone from any floor. In this parlor, enter, gentlemen, you see Hartford's first telephone in its particular little niche there. Since I was one of the first to install the infernal device, there were precious few other telephonic interlocutors I might talk to. Here's the drawing room. The stencil designs on the walls were from Lockwood DeForest. A partner in the firm begun by Mr. Tiffany, added Howells. This little solar conservatory area was where my girls would put on their plays, said Clemens, gesturing to an area filled with plants. You see how the drapes can be drawn across here like a theater curtain?
Clemens paused and then seemed to look at the room and peer into the adjoining rooms for the first time.
This is strange, he said in a choked voice. For the first year or so we were abroad, Livy and I had all the furniture, carpets, vases, beds, knick-knacks, in storage. But when John and Alice leased the place, rather than have the young couple furnish such a large house, we got everything out of storage for them, for a small additional fee. But
Clemens walked into the library and returned to the drawing room. Above the broad, carved mantel in front of them was a window looking out onto the yard from above the fireplace. Clemens patted it.
This was my idea. Few things are cozier than sitting inside on a winter day with one's family, watching the snow fall just above the crackling fire.
He touched little carvings and vases set along the mantel and atop the bookcases on either side.
John and Alice have placed everything just as we had it, he said in that strange voice. Every vase and carpet that Livy and I had purchased on our early travels, every beloved by the children carving and knick-knack.
He touched one of the carved pieces on the mantel.
You see, every Saturday, Susie and Jean and Clara would demand stories about various ornaments and paintings that stood on these top shelves and on this mantelpiece. At one end of the procession, you see, was a framed oil painting of a cat's head. At the other end was a head of a beautiful young girl, life-size, called Emmeline, an impressionist watercolor. Between the one picture and the other, there were 12 or 15 of the bric-a-brac things. Oh, and also an oil painting by Elihu Vedder, the young Medusa. So my little girls required me to construct a romance, always impromptu, not a moment's preparation permitted. And into that romance, I had to get all that bric-a-brac and the 3 pictures. I had to start always with the cat and finish with Emmeline. I was never allowed the refreshment of a change, end for end. It was not permissible to introduce a bric-a-brac ornament into the story out of its place in the procession. These bric-a-bracs were never allowed a peaceful day, a reposeful day, a restful Sabbath. In their lives there was no Sabbath. In their lives there was no peace. They knew no existence but a monotonous career of violence and bloodshed. In the course of time, the bric-a-brac and the pictures showed wear. It was because they had had so many and such violent adventures in their romantic careers.
Good practice for a writer, chuckled Howells.
The stories often included a circus, said Clemens.
He hadn't seemed to have heard Howells. He didn't seem to remember that the other men were in the room with him.
The girls truly loved stories about a circus, and so I usually wove a circus into...
Clemens seemed stunned. He took a few staggering steps and collapsed more than sat in a flowery chair.
Sam? Said Howells. I'm all right, said Clemens,
shielding his eyes with his hand as if hiding tears.
It's just that it is only, you see, that everything is in its proper place.
The others stood without knowing what to say.
I promised Livy that even though I had to see old Hartford friends about investing in some of my endeavors, I would not get close enough to the Farmington Avenue house, even to see its high chimney. But as soon as I entered the front door here, I was seized with a furious desire to have my entire family in this house again, and right away, and never go outside the grounds of Nook Farm any more forever. Certainly never again to Europe.
Clemens lowered his hand and looked around him, as if in a dream.
Everything in its place. Everything that Livy and I so treasured and shopped for and debated purchasing and celebrated in what now feels like our youth. When the girls were babies or toddlers or wee ones.
He turned and looked directly into the eyes of Howells, then James, and finally Holmes.
How ugly, tasteless, repulsive are all the domestic interiors I have ever seen in Europe, gentlemen. Compare that Baroque awfulness with the perfect taste of this ground floor, with its delicious dream of harmonious color and its all-pervading spirit of peace and serenity and deep, deep contentment. This is simply nothing more than the loveliest home that ever was.
It is beautiful, Sam, said Howells. It was as if Clemens hadn't heard him speak.
Somehow, through some dark, malevolent enchantment, I had wholly forgotten our home's olden aspect,
he said softly, speaking to himself.
This,
Clemens simultaneously slapped his palms on the arms of his chair and brought his polished shoes down hard on the floor, although he meant to signify neither in its isolation.
This place, to me, gentlemen, is bewitchingly bright and splendid and homelike and natural. And it seems at this moment as if I have just burst awake out of a long and hellish dream. It is, gentlemen, as if I have never been away, and that I will turn my head,
he did so toward the stairway,
and see my dearest Livy drifting down out of those dainty upper regions with the little children tagging after her.
He looked at them each in turn again.
But I feel in my heart that it is not to be, that it is never to be.
No one spoke after this. Clemens passed his hands over his eyes again and stood abruptly.
Enough of this nonsense, he said, voice harsh. Let us get up to the billiards room on the third floor where I kept my typewriter, that instrument of the devil around which Mr. Holmes's murder investigation pivots so ingeniously.
Chapter 24 James and Howells were trailing behind Clemens and Holmes, and on the second-story landing, Howells touched James's sleeve to bring him to a stop.
This was Sam and Livy's bedroom,
whispered Howells, pointing to a door at the far end of the hall as Clemens and Holmes climbed out of sight to the third floor.
In Italy, they'd bought this amazingly large bed with such an intricately carved headboard that Sam and Livy always put their pillows at the footboard end. So, Sam would say, that staggeringly expensive headboard would be the last thing they'd see at night and the first thing they'd see in the morning. John and Alice Day provided their own bed, so Sam and Livy's carved wonder is still in storage.
James nodded, but Howells's soft grip on his forearm continued. Using his free hand to point to another door far down the hallway, Howells whispered,
"That was always my room when I visited. Many's the time that I would awake to some stealthy sound at 1, 2, even 3 o'clock in the morning, only to peer out and see Sam in his nightshirt carrying a billiards cue, walking the halls in search of a playmate, as it were."
"Did you accommodate him?" whispered James.
"Almost always," said Howells with a soft chuckle. "Almost always."
Clemens's voice suddenly roared down the stairway.
"Are you two coming up, or are you busy ransacking through drawers down there in search of treasure? I need someone to play billiards with. The world's foremost consulting detective doesn't know how to play the game and refuses to be taught."
Henry James made mental notes of the American writer's billiards room, the inward sloping walls. This room was at the top of the tallest tower rising from the home, had been painted a light red that bordered on pink. The room was dominated by the 5-foot by 10-foot billiards table, and James noticed that it was one of the more recently designed pocket billiards tables, with the 6 holes and external pockets of gold cloth and tassels at each corner and halfway down each long side. The billiards pockets gave a sense of Christmas stocking celebration to the room, and the sloping ceilings made it feel like what it was, a playroom in a high attic. The floor was completely carpeted over with a Persian rug that boasted patches of more and brighter red amongst its intricate designs. A brick fireplace on the far wall was offset from the center of the table and room, and James could imagine how cozy this small, high room could be in the winter or on a chilly and stormy summer night. Next to the fireplace was a rough-hewn and open-faced storage cabinet rising about 5 feet high. There were still a few stacks of papers and books in it. A few feet beyond the far end of the billiards table was a table with an oil lamp on it, but actual lighting at night would be provided by the 4 large, upward-opening gas lamps suspended low over the table on a 4-spoke brass chandelier. Beyond both the billiards table and writing table was a door opening out to one of the balconies. Sunlight poured in through the fanlight over that door, through the tall lights on either side of it, and through smaller square windows low to the floor. There was no door on the wall to James's left as he entered, but the tall, fanlight-topped windows there were of stained glass with its central design showing crossed pool cues, a smoldering cigar between the cues, and a foam-topped glass mug of beer above the center of the crossed cues.
"My family crest," said Clemens,
who had already lighted a fresh cigar and was pacing back and forth between the fireplace and the billiards table, a cue stick in his hand.
"Shakespeare's family crest boasted only a sort of sickly-looking pen against what Ben Jonson called a mustardy background. Mine is better, I think."
James noticed that the theme of crossed cue sticks was also repeated on the painted ceiling. In the far left corner, in front of one of the low, square windows, was a smaller table with the typewriter and what looked to be some lead typesetting slugs on it. Holmes was already there.
"May I put this machine on that table and try it out?" asked Holmes.
Clemens just flicked a fast glance to his left.
"By all means."
He removed the cigar and stared at Howells and James.
"Now, Mr. James, would you join me in a fast game of pocket billiards to decide who is the Anglo-American literary billiards champion of the world?"
"Alas," demurred James, "I do not play, have never played. I would never risk vandalizing that perfect field of green bays by attempting to learn to play today."
"No,"
said Clemens, audibly disappointed.
"Are you sure, sir? In all of its many versions, billiards is most amusing and satisfactory, you see, and when I play badly and lose my temper, it shall almost certainly amuse you. Unless, of course, you are one of those blue-light Methodist preacher sorts who find oaths, epithets, blasphemies, and inventive obscenities objectionable."
James held his hand up, palm out, and seemed to underline his rejection by taking a step backward. He noticed the mismatched furniture in the room, a few more small tables, wicker chairs, rocking chairs, and a couple of what he thought of as Wild West saloon chairs. He chose one of the few upholstered chairs to his left and sat.
"Very well,"
exhaled Clemens with a cloud of smoke.
"Howells, old foe, dear friend, fine foil, it is just you and me again."
Howells went around to choose a cue stick from where they were propped up against the wall to the left of the fireplace.
"Please observe," said Sherlock Holmes, "that the blank white card I am placing in the typewriter is identical in size, texture, and cotton content to the one received by Henry Adams, the Hayes, and Clarence King every December on the anniversary of Clover Adams's death. Ned Hooper also received one each year before his untimely death this last December."
"How do you know it's the same cotton content and all that?"
asked Clemens.
"I took the liberty of analyzing the card under my microscope and with some portable chemical apparatus I'd brought to Washington with me," said the detective.
Holmes centered the card and typed a few words. For a moment, everyone gathered behind him. She was murdered. The detective had set out six of the cards received by the Hayes and one on loan from Clarence King, and now he set the new card flush below each of the old ones.
"You see," said Holmes, "this chip in the A, this tendency in each card for the R to be above the bottom alignment, the shape and increasing murkiness within the closed loop of the D, and the common opacity within the angles of the W."
No one said anything. Now that his attention had been brought to the small imperfections, James could see them as a product of this machine. He also noticed that each small problem was more distinct on the card Holmes had just typed. Holmes seemed to read his mind.
"Use has somewhat exaggerated these nicks and alignment problems," said the detective. "Since the original seven cards we have here look exactly the same, I would deduce that they were all typed at the same time, necessarily at least 7 years ago, since the Hayes, King, and presumably Mr. Adams all received their first card on 6 December, 1886.
Clemens thrust out his fists, wrists close together as if awaiting hand manacles.
"I confess, I will go peacefully."
Holmes twitched an impatient shadow of a smile.
"I presume, Mr. Clemens, that it would not have been difficult, say during the daytime, for one of your house guests to come into your billiards room and spend a few minutes typing a few dozen cards?"
"Certainly it's possible,"
said Clemens, putting the cigar between his teeth and striding back to the billiards table.
"Even at night, no one save for me would have noticed the sound of typing and been curious."
James cleared his throat.
"You had no need for your typewriting machine while you have been in England and Europe the last few years?" he asked.
"Obviously not,"
said Clemens, leaning forward over the edge of the table and positioning his cue in that odd but graceful sprawl of arms and elbows.
"The last few years in Europe, I have written longhand once again, and, in the few instances I wanted a typed version of any of my manuscripts, I hired a stenographer who provided the machine along with his or her note-taking skills."
"Could I impose upon you, Mr. Clemens," said Holmes, "to provide me with the names and last known addresses of all the servants who worked for you here in 1886?
"The list will be somewhere here in the house,"
grumbled Clemens.
"I shall find it for you before we leave today. May we resume our game now?"
"By all means," said Holmes.
Clemens smashed the white ball into a random cluster of waiting balls. Three of those he'd struck with his ball, or which had been struck in ricochet, went into three of the pockets. Clemens straightened up and put chalk on the end of his cue as Howells frowned and leaned over the table.
"In billiards, that's called nigger luck," said Clemens. "Did you keep a guest book from 1885 until you began your travels?"
asked Holmes.
"Yes," said Clemens. "I don't believe we packed them away, and John and Alice Day keep their own guest book. There's a drawer in that table at which you're sitting, Mr. Holmes.
Yes, just lift up that tablecloth a bit.
Holmes removed 4 leather-bound 8x12 journals or ledgers.
May I?
Began the detective. Clemens nodded. Howells struck the white ball, and it caromed off 2 other balls and 2 of the side cushions before being the only ball to go in a pocket.
Heck and spit and damnation, muttered the former editor.
I'll rack them up properly and we'll start again, Clemens said to Howells. I don't know why I've come to enjoy pocket billiards more than the carom billiards that stole so much of my youthful time, energy, and fortune. Most of the tables in England and Europe don't even have pockets.
While Clemens retrieved the white ball and shoved the others toward the point on the table where a wooden triangle waited, Holmes said,
Mr. Clemens, you and your family had many hundreds of visitors. Per year, it looks like.
Yes, well, said Clemens, and just trailed off in whatever he was going to say.
I have nothing to hide, Mr. Holmes. I am serene in knowing that I have stealthily excised the pages on which Madame Dufarge and her writhing pack of belly-dancing virgins have written their names and left their comments on the visit.
Holmes looked up from the books filled with their hundreds of scrawls.
Perhaps, if it might be possible. Yes, yes, said Clemens. Those 4 guest books cover 1885 until we all sailed in June of 1891. All the names of all our overnight guests are there. Take the books with you, but make sure that Hay returns them to me in pristine condition. For I am certain, you see, that someday my biographers will have much need to refer to those guest books after they're done with the immediate task of blotting the spot where I leave off. Thank you, muttered Holmes. But I won't need to borrow the guestbooks. Merely memorize the December 85 pages and all of the 1886.
Holmes began flipping through the pages of names and comments, running his finger down each page.
You can memorize those hundreds of signatures and comments merely by looking at them once?
Asked Clemens. His tone sounded dubious to James's ear. Holmes's finger paused, and he looked up at the others.
Unfortunately, my memory has been like this since I was a small boy. If I see something, I can call it back at any time. It is more of a curse than gift. But it must be wonderfully handy in your line of work, said Howells. At times, quite so, said Holmes. But it took me years to learn how to deliberately forget things which were of no use to me. Remind me never to play poker with you, Mr. Holmes, said Sam Clemens.
But Holmes had immersed himself in the 1886 guestbook again, his finger rapidly sliding down page after page. Clemens shrugged and gestured toward Howells, who leaned forward, got the white ball in his sights, and rocketed it into the triangle of clustered spheres. Balls rolled and caromed everywhere. One went in. Howells continued, sinking a second, then third, before failing to get any in a hole on his 4th attempt.
I presume we are playing 8-ball, Sam, Howells said. Aha, said Clemens, flicking ash into a waiting bowl. Assumptions are dangerous, Howells. In truth, we're shooting straight pool. 15 points wins.
What can you tell me about billiards technique, based on what I have seen so far?
Asked Henry James as Clemens lined up his next shot.
Well, said Clemens, from observing both Howells and me, you can see that if your ball glides along in the intense and immediate vicinity of the object ball, and a score seems exquisitely imminent, you must lift one leg, then one shoulder, then squirm your body around in sympathy with the direction of the moving ball. And at the instant when the ball seems on the point of colliding, you must throw up both your arms violently. Your cue will probably break a chandelier, and then catch fire from the exposed gas jet, as Howells has demonstrated here in this very room so many times. But no matter. You have done what you could to help the final score.
The game proceeded, Clemens evidently winning, when suddenly Holmes finished scanning the thick guestbook, slammed it shut, and said,
"You had Rebecca Lorne and her cousin as guests in February of 86.
"Lorne? Lorne?" said Clemens, his head snapping up with its lion's mane of white hair.
"Oh, yes, I remember the woman and her shy cousin. What was his name? Carlton? No, Clifton. Cliff, with one F, as Miss Lorne called him. I couldn't have told you that it was in February of 86, not so soon after Clover Adams' suicide."
"How did you know them?" asked Holmes.
"Oh, I'd met Miss Lorne the previous summer. No, early autumn, just after Congress had convened, while I was staying with Hay and Adams for a few days as I lobbied before a congressional committee for my copyrights. She was spending quite a bit of time with Mrs. Adams, with Clover, as I recall. Henry Adams was beside himself with worry about Clover's unhappiness. It's why I shifted my visit from his home to Hay's, and it seemed as if Rebecca Lorne was the only friend who visited her on a regular basis during that dark time."
"But how did she and her cousin Clifton end up spending a night with you here in Hartford, 2 months after Clover's death?" asked Holmes. "Had you struck up a separate friendship or habit of correspondence with Miss Lorne and her cousin?"
"Heavens no," said Clemens. "As I remember, the two simply dropped by one Sunday to pay their respect, a Sunday in the middle of the month, as I recall."
"The 14th of February," said Holmes, whose gray-eyed stare was so intense that it might have frightened Clemens if the humorist writer hadn't been staring into space as he tried to remember Rebecca Lorne and her visit.
"That's right," said Clemens. "But you must remember, Detective, that this was more than 7 years ago. Miss Lorne and her cousin Clifton stopped by to pay their respects since they, or at least Rebecca Lorne, were aware that I'd known Clover Adams for years, and they ended up having to spend the night because of a terrible snowstorm that swept in that afternoon. I remember that Livy insisted they stay with us rather than try to get to the train station. I believe they were going to Boston at the time, not just visiting, as I recall, but in the process of moving there from Washington."
Clemens leaned on his cue stick, getting blue rosin on his cuff, and fixed Holmes with a stare almost as intense as the gaze the detective had shown only a moment earlier.
"Why this interest in Miss Lorne, Mr. Holmes? Is she a suspect in this investigation of yours?"
"She is an unknown factor, Mr. Clemens," said Holmes, not shrinking from the writer's formidable gaze. "Mrs. Adams, Clover, had known Rebecca Lorne for only a year, yet they seemed the most intimate of friends in the weeks and months before Mrs. Adams's apparent suicide."
"Apparent suicide?" barked Clemens. "How could it be anything but suicide, Mr. Holmes? Henry Adams himself found her body, still warm after drinking the cyanide from her photographic developing potions."
"With Miss Rebecca Lorne waiting outside the house," said Holmes, "Miss Lorne may have been the last person to see Clover Adams alive."
"You are misinformed, Mr. Holmes," barked Clemens, his face growing dark above the white mustache. "I have it from Henry Adams himself that he encountered Miss Lorne waiting outside their house at 1607 H Street because she had come to visit Clover but had been waiting to go up because no one answered the bell."
Holmes nodded. "You have it from Henry Adams himself that the woman who called herself Rebecca Lorne said that she had been waiting outside when no one answered the bell. But there remains the possibility that Miss Lorne had visited Clover Adams during the few minutes that Henry Adams was gone and was coming out of the home at 1607 H Street rather than waiting outside it."
"Preposterous," cried Clemens.
"Possibly," said Holmes.
"And what do you mean by saying the woman who called herself Rebecca Lorne, sir? Who else might she be?"
"Indeed," said Holmes.
James had been watching this exchange with the utmost interest, and now he looked to Holmes to give his theory about Lorne being the woman Holmes had known as Irene Adler. Instead, Holmes asked the humorist,
"During Miss Lorne's brief visit here in Hartford, or during your earlier encounters with her in Washington, did she give you the sense of having ever been familiar with theatrical life?"
"Theatrical life?" repeated Clemens, lighting a new cigar.
"I don't know what you..."
"Wait.
Wait, now that you mention it, I remember telling Livy after their visit, this woman has been on the stage. Yes, by God, I remember now."
"Did she say as much?" asked Holmes.
No, not in the least," laughed Clemens. "But once when her cousin Clifton took the wrong chair at dinner, next to her, not what couples or guests do at another's table, she'd said, 'You've missed your mark.' And another time, we were playing billiards that evening. Mrs. Lorne, or whoever she might be, was deucedly good at the game. Turned to her cousin as he was ready to take a shot, and she said, 'Break a leg.' Now, as far as I know, those terms are little known outside the theater. Do you actually think that Rebecca Lorne might have been upstairs with Clover Adams when the poison was taken?"
asked William Dean Howells, the billiards cue still in his hand. It had been so long since Howells had said anything that all heads turned toward him.
"It's possible," said Holmes. "It is more likely that the woman taking the name Rebecca Lorne had been posted outside to make noise should Henry Adams return early, which he did."
James blinked. He'd not heard this part of Holmes's surmising before, and it made a terrible, dark sense.
"Make noise," said Clemens, clearly not seeing the implications. "So that the man she called her cousin Clifton would not be interrupted in whatever he was doing upstairs with Clover," said Holmes. "But Adams went straight upstairs," said Howells, his face white with horror. "He saw only Clover's body on the floor." "Even though the Adamses' old house was much smaller than Henry Adams's current home, it also had a rear servant's staircase," said Holmes. "I inquired."
Sam Clemens exhaled blue smoke.
"So he could have come quietly down that rear stairs, while poor Adams went up the main stairs," he rasped. "And out the back door, no doubt."
Clemens turned to Holmes.
"Do you know the true identity of this cousin Clifton?"
"I do,"
Holmes said softly, and with not the least tone of triumph or superiority.
"There was no record of Clifton Richards in Washington or Boston, save for the 6 months previous to Clover's death, when this Clifton worked in the photographic supplies department in the Department of State. It was he who provided the new developing solution, with the cyanide, to Clover Adams. He resigned and disappeared in January of 86, just a few weeks after Mrs. Adams's death. His true identity, absolutely confirmed by me only yesterday, is that of Lucan Adler, an international anarchist and deadly assassin."
"My God!"
cried Clemens, sending the billiards cue crashing onto the green baize table.
"Livy and I hosted a murderess and murderer. We could have been poisoned at our own table, stabbed in the night, smothered to death in our own bed."
Holmes smiled thinly.
"Possible, but not probable. It was not you they were after, but rather Clover Adams. They closed their circle around her for months."
"But why?" asked Clemens. "Clover offended some members of the Washington establishment, but certainly no one disliked her to the point of wanting to kill her."
"That is what I am looking into," said Holmes.
At this moment, I fear that a former actress and adventuress named Irene Adler and her son Lucan Adler arranged Mrs. Adams's death primarily in order to bring me to the States.
The other three men could only stare at the detective. Finally, James said, "Bring you here? To America? In December of 85 or the winter of 86, you mean?"
"No," said Holmes. "To bring me here after Ned Hooper brought me the evidence of the 'she was murdered' cards. To bring me here now."
For a moment, no one said anything. Then Clemens took Howells's cue, set it against the wall with his own, and said,
"Come with me, please, gentlemen."
James had assumed that Clemens was going to show them out of the house. The brougham and driver were still waiting in the driveway, but instead their host led them out onto a covered second-story porch. It was a wide porch with a wonderful view and seven rocking chairs waiting there in the shade.
"Please be seated, gentlemen," said Clemens. "You may choose any rocker, save for this one."
He had his hands on the back of a mustard-yellow rocker with well-dented cushions.
"And God bless John and Alice Day for keeping everything here where it should be."
When they were all seated, Howells and James lit cigarettes. Holmes worked to get his pipe drawing properly. Clemens found yet another cigar in a pocket, bit off the end, spit the shred over the railing, and lit the cigar with a satisfied grunt. James had smoked cigars, but he did not pretend to be an aficionado of the many brands. He only knew from the smoke that Clemens's cigar was a cheap cigar. Clemens caught his gaze.
"I used to smoke cigarettes as you do, Mr. James, but Olivia told me that it was a dirty habit and certainly no benefit to my health. So, on the principle that the only way to break one bad habit was by replacing it with an even worse habit, I began smoking cigars."
Howells guffawed at this, although he must have heard it many times before.
"But I do follow Livy's admonitions to moderation, Mr. James," continued Clemens. "I rarely smoke more than one cigar at a time." "Have you ever tried to break the habit, Mr. Clemens?" asked Holmes.
James immediately thought of Holmes's syringe and his addiction to whatever he was daily injecting into himself. Holmes also smoked constantly, varying between cigarettes and his pipes. Was Holmes really curious about whether Twain had found a way to break his addiction to tobacco?
"Oh, of course," laughed Clemens. "It's easy to quit smoking. I've done it hundreds of times."
James saw Howell's smile and Holmes nod recognition of the tiny clench. They were, James knew, bits and pieces of prepared and rehearsed lines that had flowed from the podium and over footlights many times, but James was not offended by being turned into yet another audience. Clemens seemed to require an audience at all times. But for several moments, Clemens fell silent, and no one else spoke. The only sound was the unsynchronized creaking of their four rocking chairs and ambient bird sounds and leaves stirring in the wind. James wondered if the great elms and chestnut trees and maples might be further along in their stately process of leafing out than usual for the end of March. The smaller dogwoods were in their glory. Henry James remembered winter surrendering its sovereignty in Cambridge, with frigid and snowy rearguard actions deep into April and some late springs, including the year a decade ago when his parents died, and he had stayed behind to sort out insurance and monies owed and monies promised. He remembered how he and Alice James, the other Alice James, William's wife, had begged William by letter not to return home from his sabbatical in England. His presence would have only made the confusion of money going to Wilkie and others, of Henry forsaking his own share of their father's modest fortune by signing it over to their sister Alice, of Aunt Kate's and sister Alice's part in all this, hopeless. William had stayed in England and Europe, but not without threatening 100 times that he would board the next ship, U.S. bound. That had been a sad but deeply satisfying few months for Henry James. For once, he was undoubtedly and indisputably in charge of the family, its finances, its security, its future with both parents now gone, and he had liked the feeling. He had liked being free and separate from the shadow of the all-powerful older brother, William. The wind rustled leaves again, and James enjoyed the view from this high porch. He could see the white gazebo, needing paint now, where Clemens had spent starry nights talking with Harriet Beecher Stowe, or so he had said. James had read that the old lady, in her 80s, was almost an invalid now, and no longer interested in life or ideas since her husband had died. James remembered reading the novel, Uncle Tom's Cabin, or Life Among the Lowly, only a year or two after it had been published in 1852. Henry James Jr. was only 10 years old, but he had instantly seen the crude melodrama of the novel as the propaganda broadside it was meant to be, filled with stereotypes and unartistic exaggerations, not drawn from life. But he had also sensed the flame of fury and indignation that had driven the author. And even then, at 10 years of age, Henry James had known for a certainty that he would never write anything, or paint anything, or create anything from any similar boundless passion. His work, he knew even before he had known what direction his work in life might take him, would all be minded, carefully thought out and planned, deliberate, well-chewed. Samuel Clemens turned his rocker so that he could look directly at James and said,
"I had dinner in Florence with your brother just a few months ago."
"Indeed," James said politely, his heart sinking. Of course, William had written to him about the encounter. Of course, William had thought it significant, primarily due to sharing his wisdom with this rustic who had so presumptuously dismissed his younger brother Harry's book, The Bostonians. But in the end, James remembered, after many Italian courses and several bottles of wine, William had come away deeply impressed with this Mark Twain-Samuel Clemens dual personality.
"We talked until very late, until the waiters were making noise with brooms and coughing discreetly to let us know it was far past the Florentine restaurant's closing time," said Clemens. "And for the last 2 hours, I did little more than listen to your brother."
"I am sure that is the case," thought Henry James. "Thus it is with me, his wife, and most of his interlocutors."
"I was in something like awe," said Clemens.
He turned toward the other two men in their rockers.
"You both know of Mr. William James's amazing book, Principles of Psychology?"
Holmes merely nodded, but Howells said in mock anger,
"Know of it? Sam, I not only penned one of the earliest positive reviews of the book, but I was the first to recommend it to you. I purchased a second copy of it myself and mailed it to you with an admonition to read it despite your aversion to dry books, if I recall correctly."
"And I do recall correctly." "It's an amazing book," continued Clemens as if Howells had not spoken. "But in our conversation in Florence, William James elaborated even further than his seminal book does on the definitions of and differences between I and me."
"Oh my," thought James, trying to calm his thoughts by looking out toward the distant gazebo once again.
"Mr. Holmes," cried Clemens, leaning toward the thin man in his black suit and long black scarf, despite the warmth of the day, "do you enjoy being a detective?"
"It is what I do," said Holmes after the briefest of pauses. Clemens nodded as if the answer satisfied him deeply.
"The published stories of your adventures are becoming very popular both here and, as I understand it, in England."
Holmes said nothing to this.
"Are you satisfied with the way Dr. Watson and Mr. Doyle present your adventures?"
pressed Clemens.
"I've never had the pleasure of making Mr. Doyle's acquaintance.
As for Watson's writing, many is the time I've told him that his little romances based on my cases mistakenly emphasize drama, and sometimes, I admit, melodrama, rather than the cold, sure science of deduction that he could have shared with interested and intelligent readers."
Holmes leaned forward on his walking cane. "Furthermore," he said, "both Watson and his editor and agent, Mr. Doyle, have a deep fear of mentioning any well-known public names, or even private ones, or even the accurate place or time, in the published tales. More often than not, it leads to a great confusion in the tales themselves. The published versions hardly ever match the original notes in my case files."
"But you enjoy being a detective?"
Clemens asked again. "It is what I do," repeated Holmes. Clemens laughed and slapped his knee.
"By God, I am going to write a book called Tom Sawyer, Detective. Between my beloved literary character and your profession, sir, we shall sell 1,000,000 copies."
Holmes said nothing to this.
"Enjoy your pipe and cigarettes, gentlemen," cried Clemens, "for I am now going to explain Mr. William James's brilliant definitions of the quite different I and me in all of us, and should show Mr. Holmes why he might be correct in thinking that he does not exist."